You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Jack L. High has published hundreds of articles and more than a dozen books, including Face in the Mirror, The Lost Brothers, and The Lobotomist, A Maverick Medical Genius and His Tragic Quest to End the World of Mental Illness. He has contributed articles to Scientific American, Wired, Discover, GQ, The Atlantic, Smithsonian, Eon, The Washington Post Magazine, and many other publications. He's won the June Roth Memorial Award for Medical Journalism, Outstanding Article Honors from the American Society of Journalists and Authors, and other awards. He's the author of The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, Hermann Goering, Dr. Douglas M. Kelly, and A Fatal Meeting of Minds at the End of World War II, which has just been adapted as the film Nuremberg. Thank you for joining me, Jack.
Oh, thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
You know, what strikes me is that World War II, which is ended 80 years ago, is more relevant today even than it was back when it ended. And I think one thing that strikes me is, as a kid, when I was back in junior high, I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William R. Scharrer. It's a magnificent book, and I just started rereading it, wondering if it would hold up after all of that time, and it does. It's a magnificent piece of storytelling. And I read your book, and I thought, my God, here's a man who has taken what is a pixel, essentially, from the Scharrer's work and from the story of World War II, and turn that into an equally compelling piece of storytelling. So I'd like you to talk with us how you discovered Douglas M. Kelly, his part in Nuremberg, and found his incredible story.
Dr. Douglas M. Kelly was a U.S. Army psychiatrist who, at the end of World War II, was assigned to spend time among the top German leadership that had been arrested at the end of the war and would eventually be charged with war crimes, crimes against peace, crimes against humanity. Dr. Kelly's job was very simple and rather small, to assess whether these defendants were mentally fit to stand trial. And that bar of mental fitness is quite low in the legal sense. It means, can they understand the charges against them? Can they participate in their own defense? Do they know right from wrong? And I'd never heard of Dr. Kelly up until about 2004, when I was researching my earlier book that you mentioned, The Lobotomist. And as it happened, that book was about another psychiatrist, Walter Freeman. And Dr. Freeman, in his unpublished memoir, mentioned meeting Dr. Kelly, this interesting man, at a conference of the American Psychiatric Association in 1938. And what struck Dr. Freeman about Dr. Kelly, and this really stayed with me for several years until I acted upon it, was that Dr. Kelly was at this conference not to present a paper or to give a talk. He was there to give a magic show. And he was a very devoted stage magician, and gave a magic show to this audience of hundreds of psychiatrists, which I would think would be a really intimidating crowd, but he did it. And I later learned that Dr. Kelly was involved in Nuremberg, and that's when I really started getting interested in him. So I started looking for sources of information about him. And I eventually tracked down his son, Doug, who was living in Northern California at the time. wrote to Doug and said, I was interested in his dad's career. Does he have anything? And Doug wrote back and said, yes, I do. Why don't you come and take a look? And so I came. I was hoping or expecting that Doug had, you know, maybe a scrapbook or a photo album, some few file folders. But when I got to Doug's house, he had brought up from his basement 15 banker's boxes full of papers and artifacts, most of which were materials that Dr. Kelly had brought back home to the States with him from Nuremberg. And when I started going through this mass of material, it was clear right away to me that these papers and artifacts, which had not been seen by anybody outside the Kelly family for decades, were very intriguing and could form the basis, the foundation of an important book. And so I got to work, visited Doug many times in order to go through all those boxes. And that's how the book came to be. Of course, I did other research, other archives, interviews, all the rest, but that's how it started.
You know, that description brings up two questions for me. One of them, the first is that Kelly himself must have been very interested in storytelling and in telling his own story and understood the import of what he was doing. So talk about telling the story of a storyteller. And I think the magic is really a key part of this, in that magic, you know, stage magic, is a way of using our ability to, you know, turn clouds into stories about gods and monsters into, like, you know, using storytelling to fool the mind, to have the mind fool itself.
Yes. And that's why Dr. Kelly was interested in stage magic. Magic is often characterized as a way to deceive the eye, but Kelly made the point that it's really a way to deceive the mind. And what a stage magician is doing is manipulating the audience. And so I'll get back to that in a second. But Dr. Kelly, when he found himself amid these men who were widely considered the arch criminals of the 20th century, he saw he had an incredible opportunity, and to do more than just what the court was asking him to do, to assess whether they met that low bar of mental fitness. He wanted to find out whether they shared any common psychiatric illness between them that would account for their heinous and criminal behavior before and during the war. And there were many other psychiatrists, psychologists, who wanted access to these guys. And initially, Kelly was the only one who had it for quite a while. And so he decided to make the most of it. Now, getting back to the stage magic and the manipulation that's involved in it, one of the defendants who interested Kelly the most was Hermann Göring. He was the highest ranking of the Germans who were in prison awaiting trial. He had been Hitler's successor for almost the entire war. He had a multitude of offices in the German Reich, and the most important probably was that he was the head of the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. And so Kelly set about trying to understand Göring. Why did Göring do what he did? He was enormously influential in the Nazi regime. Now, Kelly didn't initially understand this, but Göring was just as skilled a manipulator as Kelly was. And so these two men, who actually had a lot in common, set about to mutually manipulate each other. And they were both aware of what they were doing, but it was worthwhile for both of them because they could get important things they wanted from each other. Goering very badly wanted information and news and a channel of communication with his family, his wife and daughter, who at one point were also under arrest, then later released from prison. Even the little girl was spending time in a prison. And Kelly eventually agreed to serve as a conduit. This was completely under the table, not sanctioned, between Goering and his family, passing letters between the two. And in a sort of trade, Goering gave Kelly access to his thoughts. And he submitted to all of these batteries of tests that Kelly had brought with him, the Rorschach inkblot test, another test called the thematic apperception test, IQ tests, all of it. And they both got what they wanted. And the manipulation that's inherent in stage magic was their main tools that they used against the other.
You know, one thing that I found fascinating was that Kelly, who was a scientist and a doctor, was really skilled at manipulating not just Goering, but the system. He made sure that the setup he had at Nuremberg gave him access to the people in the way he wanted, and he was able to do what he did with virtually no restraints. And for a man who was trying to understand why people were, why the Nazis were, as he considered, most people thought at the time, insane, he was just happy to just figure out and set up a way to evade anybody stopping him from doing what he wanted to do.
That's right. He was working under everybody's radar. Even the commandant of the prison in Nuremberg, a man named Burton Andrus, did not know for a very long time what Kelly was up to when he was giving these 22 men these batteries of tests and spending long hours interviewing them in their cells. This was Kelly's private project, and it kept him very busy for how long? It was probably about 8 months, and he spent more time than anybody else with the prisoners, both before and during the trial in the early months of this first Nuremberg trial. It was called the International Military Tribunal. It was jointly operated by the four biggest allied powers, the US, USSR, France, and Britain. And it was the world's first trial for war crimes ever conducted by an international tribunal. So it was a historic and very important event to settle in a courtroom what had begun on a battlefield.
One of the things that I found fascinating as I read this book was your ability to weave the story of these great characters, Andrus, Goering, Kelly, his later, Gilbert, his later kind of competitors, psychiatrist, and Kelly's story after the war, his just long-suffering wife. Talk about discovering and creating these characters. And one of the things I think that I love about this book is this is not, does not show us necessarily pictures of what, you know, was happening. You have some great descriptions of Nuremberg itself, but this is an interior journey for all of these characters, and especially Goering and Kelly. It's a just fascinating look into using character to tell story.
Yes. Well, thank you for that. The materials that Sun Doug brought up from his basement included records that helped me create these character portraits. So the records included medical records for each of the German defendants. Kelly asked each of them to write an autobiography. And so all of those were in there. Some of them were written in English, some in German. Also in there were memos that Kelly sent and received from the court itself and from the prosecution team. And his Rorschach test records and interpretations of those tests. So just by going through that great mass of material, I could learn a lot about each of the individual defendants. And they were very different from one another. It's a famous belief that the German perpetrators were dull, boring, everyday people. And that was not true of the leadership. No one on earth who had met Hermann Göring would call him dull and ordinary. He was a spectacularly flamboyant personality who had loved to dress in these ornate uniforms and give parties and steal all kinds of art from around Europe. And it was that flamboyance that led many people in the U.S. and the U.K. to really underestimate Göring, because he was those things, but he was also highly intelligent. He was diabolically clever. He was cruel. He was ruthless. He lacked remorse. All of those things. And so he was, in a sense, more of a well-rounded person and more of a formidable person than the press in the Allied countries led their readers to believe. But there were many other bizarre personalities in the prison. Julius Streicher, who is had been a newspaper publisher in Germany, publishing a highly anti-Semitic newspaper. He was not a government official, but he was there among the top defendants.
Now, Streicher published Der Stürmer, right? Which is still around today in some incarnation, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think the English, today's English language, far-right extremist version of Der Stürmer, it's not a direct descendant. It's just a publication that took the name.
Nonetheless, not a great sign for the 21st century. You know, one of the things that interested me about this book was it's not just a history of World War II, it's also a history of psychology and psychiatry. And I think that one of the things that I was most interested in was that the Rorschach blots are A, still highly respected, B, they had just come into use then. So talk about the Rorschach blots, Douglas Kelly's adoption of them. He was really a forerunner in this, wasn't he?
He was considered a highly skilled interpreter, one of the top in the U.S., of Rorschach testing results. So for those of your listeners who don't know this test, it's a test that involves showing the subject cards. And these cards had abstract images on them made with ink blots. And some of them were black and white images, some of them had color in them. And the subject was asked to look at the card and tell the examiner what the subject saw there. And so what the subject saw could be revealing. It was thought to be revealing of their state of mind. But Kelly's interpretations went beyond just what they said they saw. He also looked at things like vocal inflections, how they told what they saw, other mannerisms they used as they were explaining, how much time it took them to come up with their stories based on the cards. So this was in the early years of Rorschach test usage, and Kelly and his contemporaries used that test to diagnose psychiatric illness. It's not used that way anymore. I think it is occasionally still used, but mostly as more of a personality test to reveal personality. Kelly used it differently, and he thought that he was able to diagnose specific psychiatric illnesses from it. And he also considered it as much an art as a science, how to interpret these results. So a big part of the papers that I found in these boxes were Rorschach tests, multiple tests with each of the defendants, and Kelly's interpretations.
Did you find actual ink blots?
Well, the set of cards used to give the ink blot test is standardized.
Oh, okay.
So the ones used now are the same as the ones used in 1945 when Kelly was using them.
Talk about the history of psychiatry, because we live in here in the 21st century, we're all in the throes of neuroscience and neuropsychology, understanding how the brain itself works. Back then, that just wasn't something that was, it was just barely being done as he later in his life. So talk about the history of psychiatry and how that, telling that story, became part of the story of this Nuremberg experience for Kelly.
We should remember that all of this was happening in 1945, 1946, and this was a time when psychiatry was greatly influenced by the work of Sigmund Freud and his use techniques of psychoanalysis. And most psychiatrists at that time, including Kelly, believed that psychiatric disorders resulted from previous experiences and our responses to experiences, even as early as childhood. Today's psychiatry is very different because it's much more about a biological approach to behavior. That is how brain chemicals affect our behavior. Much of today's psychiatry is about drugs that affect the balance of chemicals in the brain. All of that was completely unknown to Kelly and to his contemporaries. And so when Kelly spent hundreds of hours talking to the defendants at Nuremberg, he was, at times anyway, giving them talk therapy. He wasn't trying to treat them. He was trying to understand them and to determine whether they shared this common, what he called a Nazi virus that made them behave the way he did. Interestingly, by the end of his time at Nuremberg, he had concluded that there was no Nazi virus, that almost all of these men, 21 out of the 22, fell within the normal range of human behavior and personality. They were not insane. They were not ill in a psychiatric sense. To Kelly, that was even more frightening, because that meant that there are other people around us who also fall within this normal range, who could be capable of the awful crimes that the German leadership committed. And once Kelly returned to the States, he went on a completely different track, warning the United States, warning Americans about the threat of fascism in our country and what we could do to stop it, and how something like the end of a war or the end of a set of war crimes trials or the birth of an organization like the United Nations wasn't going to stop people like this from appearing among us, because they're there, and they are opportunists who will gladly stomp all over half of us to gain control over the other half of us. So Kelly changed in the course of all of this, and I find his arguments very persuasive. The Nazis were not crazy monsters. They were opportunists acting like some of us do now. That doesn't mean that everyone is capable of what they did, but there are those among us who are capable, and they're all around us. They work in every area of human endeavor, and we have to watch out for them and be prepared for their periodic reappearance.
These are the conclusions he reached in a part of the book you call The Nazi Mind. And I thought that part of the book, it could have been written 6 months ago.
Yes.
And that was kind of like shocking and terrifying to me. Talk about your journey as a writer, having written this before it became pertinent, and watching the story you told in the book unfold in front of your eyes.
When I was starting my research and writing this book, fascism, the threat of fascism and right-wing extremism was really on the fringes of political activity. This was at the start of the second Obama administration. And over time, it has moved from the edge to the center. But that is how our society has moved. It doesn't, there's no prescience on my part involved. It's just that society changed. But I, in that chapter you mentioned, The Nazi Mind, it made me, writing that, made me very aware of how fragile our democracy is and what the threats are to it. And so Kelly laid out a plan for how we can combat the threat of fascism, right-wing extremism in our country. And it involved simple steps, simple to say, not simple to do. One of them was to change our educational system to emphasize critical thinking above emotional thinking and reaction. People who think critically make better decisions and better informed decisions.
And this was due to his interest in something called semantics, which was brand new at his when he was working. Talk about semantics and how that lays into that.
The general semantics, it was a philosophy, or is, they're still around, a philosophy of thinking that I have to admit now that it's 13 years after I wrote the book, that I no longer have a solid grasp of what it's about. It's very complex, but it involved things like the belief that human knowledge, because of our ability to communicate over generations through the written word, is continuous. And that's one of the things that separates us the most from other species on our planet. And emphasizing rational thinking over emotional reaction and thinking. So I was better informed about it when I wrote the book. And so for a more detailed explanation of general semantics, I suggest that you consult the book. It's not mentioned at all in the movie Nuremberg. What was the rest of that question?
I'd like you to talk about more about, you know, the idea that the Nazi what you called and what Kelly called the Nazi virus is something that lies dormant in pretty much all of us and is just waiting for a chance to escape. And also, he was rather prescient, I think, in his perception of, you know, the problems of racism and the problems of, you know, prejudice against immigrants, which played a huge part in the rise of Nazism, and we see that today as well.
Yes. So Kelly, during his time in Nuremberg, among the German defendants, really had his eyes opened to how they thought and the justifications that they used for their crimes. And so when he came back to the States, he saw our environment with different eyes. And he looked around and he saw the Southern segregationists, people powerful in government in segregationist states, using many of these same power techniques and opportunistic methods that he had seen among the Nazis in Germany. And so he began speaking up about it. He went on some lecture circuits, talked quite a bit about it, wrote about it in a book that he published after he returned home. It's called 22 Cells in Nuremberg. It's almost impossible to find a copy now because the book flopped when it was published. Hardly any copies were actually sold. Kelly's thesis in the book that these men were not crazy monsters, but were within the normal realm of human expectations was really unpopular at the time. And that's understandable. We had just been through this long and very bloody, cruel war, and in the midst of a series of 13 Nuremberg trials to deal with the perpetrators, and nobody wanted to hear that those things wouldn't have an effect on the rise of fascism or movements like it in the future. But that's what Kelly was saying. He was saying that these things will happen. Our democracy is fragile. It can happen anywhere at any time because these people are everywhere in every time. So Kelly became a outspoken advocate of heading off incipient fascism. He also advocated, unlike as we're seeing in our society today, making voting easier for every qualified person who wanted to cast a ballot. What we've been seeing in this country for the past few years are increased restrictions on voting, even for qualified voters. And he had another recommendation that I don't think would fly now, and I'm not sure that I would support it. He believed that all candidates for political office should undergo a mandatory public psychiatric examination.
One of the things that I realized is I read your story of Nuremberg and the trials and all the decisions made then about how the defendants would be tried and what would happen and how that would all roll out, that trial, that time itself really built out the next 50 plus years of the 20th century, the structure that we've lived, that I grew up in. It's kind of falling apart now, but the whole idea of the United Nations, all of that, the International Criminal Court, all that I think can be seen as starting with Nuremberg.
That's a good observation. As you say, many things came out of the trials. One of the first was the Nuremberg Medical Code that came out of one of the trials that followed the one we've been talking about, the so-called doctor's trial. And this code governs today how medical experimentation can ethically happen. And this, of course, was a response to the medical experiments that the Nazis conducted that were most unethical and harmful. Also, one thing that came out of the trials was from the United Nations was the UN Convention on Genocide. This was adopted in 1948, and just about every country on Earth is now a signatory to that convention. It's the most widely accepted definition of genocide. It lays out seven or eight conditions, any one of which indicates a genocide. And it's very clear from looking at the Convention on Genocide that many of the events we have happening in the world around us today are genocide. And also in the recent past, such as in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia.
I thought that the human story of Kelly after his return was really just fascinating. So talk about that, because one of the things that's interesting is that as you read about Nuremberg and see that as the climax in a sense of his life, but after he came back, he did a lot of significant work, and I think that I guess his character is just has a really fascinating journey. It's a kind of reaction, you know, when you're involved at such a high level. And I think that he understood the peaks he was reaching as he sat there with Goering and understood how important that would be to the world. And then he had to come back and live his life for another number of extended years. So talk about his life after Nuremberg.
Dr. Kelly returned to the States very shaken up in a lot of ways, professionally, because he had seen that due to his inability to find a psychiatric illness that the defendants shared, he came to the conclusion that psychiatry could not account for the behavior of men like this, and that provoked a professional crisis within him. He had been so devoted to the specialty of psychiatry for so long. But when he returned to the States, he began a gradual turn towards another discipline, criminology, that he thought might offer a better explanation for the behaviors of people like this. also, he went through a number of personal setbacks and problems. He developed a drinking problem during the 1950s. His marriage was in trouble. He came to believe that, and I think this was mostly prompted by the lack of a success of his book, that he was underappreciated, that his work was not sufficiently appreciated. And he just became very depressed, and his life became hard. So this is where I mentioned earlier his son Doug. This is where Doug himself became a great and very important resource for me, because Doug was there during this time. He was a child, but he had a great recall of things that were happening in his parents' life, and what Dr. Kelly was like as a father, and what changes he underwent during the 1950s, and what pressures he felt that he was working under. And it was through Doug's eyes that I was able to better understand it. And this was a rough time for Doug. Dr. Kelly would not win Father of the Year awards from anybody. And And Doug also witnessed, and I don't think I'm giving away terribly a spoiler in saying this, he was a witness to his father's suicide on January 1st, 1958. Dr. Kelly took his own life using the same poison, cyanide, that Hermann Goering had used just before his scheduled execution in 1946. So one of the questions that I wanted to answer, or at least pursue in my book, was what was the connection between these two suicides that were done the same way? And I think I came to an answer in the book. It's not exactly what you might think it is, but it's significant and I think explains a lot. But for reasons like this, that's why I consider Doug the son to be the hero of the story, or he was the hero to me, because he lived through it and he survived it and grew up to be a warm, intelligent, great guy who had gone through terrible times and had gotten through it. And I still talk to Doug regularly, write to him, and he's still a part of my life so many years after I finished writing the book.
This book is the basis of a new movie. It's been received extremely well. And I think one of the things that interests me is for you as a writer, having lived through writing your book and having seen, I mean, you must have a kind of a diffracted view of this book. You wrote it during one time, and now many of the things that were important to the character you created in the book and the story arc you created have come into prominence and into view. What a book does is put us inside the characters. What a movie does is show us the outside in a way that impacts us visually and viscerally. Talk about your experience in having your book adapted and your understanding of the character as created in your book in reality and the character as created on film.
Mm-hmm. I think writers who are lucky enough to have this experience of having their work adapted to the screen react to it in all kinds of different ways. Many become controlling of their stories, and they want to maintain a tight grip on it. And in any important sense, from what was on the printed page. I am not like that. I was thrilled by the idea that a creative person working in a different medium, so that's James Vanderbilt, the screenwriter and director of Nuremberg, wanted to riff off, essentially, of the book I wrote, the nonfiction book I wrote, and to make something new out of it. And as you said, what he was making was going to be different from what I had created. But I didn't find that threatening, because no matter what he did, my book was always going to be there. It wasn't going anywhere. And I was just so curious to see what he might do with it. And so this took many years. The story was first optioned in 2011. This is even before I wrote the book. But before I wrote the book, I had written an article, also titled The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, for Scientific American Mind magazine. And that's what James first saw. Then he saw a copy of my book proposal, and then he saw the book. And So over the course of all these years, he would send me new drafts of the screenplay. I think I saw 4 drafts over the years. And he'd ask me to comment on them. And it took me a while to figure out, how do I want to comment? What do I want to comment on? I'm certainly not going to tell James Vanderbilt, the screenwriter of that fantastic film, Zodiac, how to write a screenplay. Right. So I'm not here to guide his screenwriting, obviously. I don't know anything about screenwriting. And I also did not want to be the history police, pointing out every historical inaccuracy in the screenplay, because given the different purposes of a movie and a nonfiction book, many of those inaccuracies are not important. What is important is that the film is essentially factual. That doesn't mean 100% factual, and that it delivers the messages that I considered important. So those were the things that I was thinking about as I made comments on James' screenplay drafts. And and so by the time we got to the 4th draft, I thought, wow, this is looking very good. And James was kind enough in 2024, once the production actually was underway, to invite me to come to Hungary, where the shooting was happening, and to spend a week or so watching, observing. And that was really thrilling and unearthly in a way. And I had a chance to talk with some of the cast members about how they saw their characters and bounce ideas off of them, and to see, it's a crew of hundreds of people involved in a movie like this, and to see everybody at work on this story that I had dug up from the boxes that were in Doug Kelly's basement. That to me was mind-blowing. And I really liked it. It was the best work trip of my life.
Book and the movie really bring to mind, I think, in contrast and together, my practice is to always read the book before you see the movie. And I think this is especially important here, because then you understand what's happening on the inside and factually, and are able to kind of surf through the movie in the paroxysm of terror and just deep understanding of where we are. So talk about the storytelling aspects for you, the story you told and the way you told it. How did you feel about seeing it in a screenplay and as a movie? The experience of story is actually, a part of this, because the Rorschach test is essentially really a riff on our ability to tell a story. Show me a picture that's not even of anything, and I will tell you a story about that picture. And, this book and this movie are essentially in themselves Rorschach tests for the viewer. How do I feel about the story I am being told?
yeah, that's a good observation. My book, The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, covers about 45 years of time. That's the lifespan of Dr. Douglas Kelly. The movie, Nuremberg, covers about 1 year, or maybe a little more, of time, which is the time that Dr. Kelly spent in Nuremberg, plus a little more. And because of that difference alone, they're going to be told in different ways. And
I was just thinking earlier, I was talking about how your book, in a sense, is like a pixel of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich expanded in discovering a whole story. The movie is, in a sense, this has the same relationship to your book.
Yeah, I think that's true. Plus, James added to it as well. He added a subplot that's in the movie about Robert Jackson, who is the lead American prosecutor. He was also a Supreme Court justice, but he was the lead American prosecutor in the trial. And Justice Jackson is in my book, but I do not follow him in the way the movie does in showing how the trial got going, all his work to get it going, and his work during the trial. Once I saw the movie and took it in, and I felt I had to tell Doug, the son, a couple of things about it before he saw it that I thought might, if not alarm him, would he'd find perplexing. And one of them was, in the movie, Doug's mother doesn't exist. So Dr. Kelly, you know, when he went to the European Theater of the War to serve in hospitals and then to be among the defendants at Nuremberg, he had already been married and was a very devoted husband, writing often to his wife.
As did Hermann Göring.
Hermann Göring, also a devoted correspondent. In the movie, Kelly's not married. And in fact, he has kind of a fling with a reporter who is a composite character who is in Nuremberg to cover the trial. And then the other thing I felt I had to warn Doug about was that people who watch the movie might get the impression that Dr. Kelly was sent home and told to leave because he had done something wrong. And the thing in the movie that is shown to be something wrong is leaking some information to that reporter with whom he was having the fling. And although he did leak information in real life to a reporter, he was scolded for that, but certainly not disciplined and certainly not sent home because of that. He left. It was his own decision to leave. Mm-hmm. He had spent many years in Europe during the war, wanted to go back. He felt like his work in Nuremberg was over. He received a promotion in rank just before he left, so he was not viewed unfavorably. And so I explained those things to Doug, and he, you know, he's a very thoughtful, sensible person. He took them in and he said, okay, I think I can take those.
I think one of the most important aspects of this is something we talked about a little bit about, which is semantics. And I think that semantics, I don't know much about but general semantics myself, but when I think about the human race is that we are a narrative species. That's the name of this podcast. And if I ask you to describe yourself, you will tell me, and you have told me today, a story. And I think we are story-bound creatures. And I think that one of the things that's really powerful about this book is the way it weaves together a variety of stories. And it shows us a life that, you know, is punctuated by amazing accomplishments and amazing experiences and ends up, you know, a little bit on the normal side. You know, he comes back to the United States and he has to get a job and he's married and he's got kids and he's, you know, has the family. We're always often shown stories of, like, you know, incredible accomplishments, and you know, you spend the rest of your life sitting on the throne with getting served a lilacs and lilies. So I think I really like your sense of story in this, because it is real and it feels that way.
Well, thank you. A big part of what I'm after when I'm writing a story is to tell the story, but in a context, that explains the motivations and actions of the people in the story, and no more. The context, that's what it's for, and it's not there for any other reason. And so a problem that I have as a reader with many works of popular history and biography is too much context. Some is important if it does the kind of explaining that it's there for. When it gets beyond that and is there in a way that feels more like a data dump, you know, the writer thinking, I did all this research, I want to get it in. That is the kind of context that I think is not helpful. But context is important. And another thing that I always try to do to limit my stories, because there's so much that could go into any book, is to focus on two or three questions that I want to pursue in the book. And if some information that I've gathered doesn't contribute to the pursuit of those questions, I'm inclined not to include it. In The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, my questions were, what exactly did Dr. Kelly learn about the German defendants at Nuremberg? And how did that affect him? And then also the question I mentioned earlier about the suicides, and what was the connection between Goering's and Kelly's suicide?
The book by Jack L. High is The Nazi and the Psychiatrist. It's been adapted into the movie Nuremberg. Thank you for joining me, Jack. This has been a delight.
It's been really interesting, Rick. Thanks for the good questions and thoughtful ideas that you've contributed.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.